Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2018. Lecture 15, delivered on March 21, 2018. The title of this lecture is Internal Rate of Return and Net Present Value.
Today, Net Present Value and Internal Rate of Return. This is the classic way. What you're learning today is the classic, I shouldn't say way, the classic methodology for evaluating whether to go with a project or say no to the project. You see, we in finance are the ones who make that determination, at least the way it should be done. The marketing people will have do I have a marketing person in here? I promise, I won't disrespect you. Okay, I will. Okay. Okay, you come up with a great idea. Okay, this is something like maybe an advertising campaign, or you recognize from marketing analytics that there's a need for a new product. Oh, God! Oh, whoa. I thought that was the angel of death right there. I was going home. What the hell was But, clear, okay. You get numbers together. Now, do I have any management science, operations management science types in here? That's a heavy one. That's a big one now. But you give some of the numbers that go along with that, how much it's going to cost for the equipment to produce the product, and then there are other people involved in other parts of the organization. Put all the numbers together. You get the projections of the revenues, and then we build these projected financials for the marginal contribution and cost of this product. And then you bring it to me, and you say, we want this project to go forward. And I'm the one who says yes or no, and I'll show you how we do it today. It's either a yes or a no. There's no in between, and that makes it our job in one way fairly easy, but the analytics that we use behind it are a little bit more intense, but they're not that hard. Before I go on any further, though, just to get you back into the flow of thinking about markets and all of that, the Federal Reserve raised interest rates that it couldn't raise, and it announced its intention to influence other interest rates in the direction it wants, which is upward. Now, when interest rates go up, all other things being equal, madam, what happens to securities prices as interest rates rise? Work it, girl, come on. What's the relationship between interest rates and prices? The higher interest rates are, the lower prices are. So as interest rates are rising, we should anticipate that markets will react adversely and drive down securities prices. And that plays into today's lecture, too. I want to make sure that you don't think this is an abstraction here. There. Okay. Right off the bat, sir, good day or bad day or just not really anything day? Call it.
Not really anything.
Good, good. And you said that with fair confidence there. This is not impressive. I mean, you got a little tick downward, and it's about the same for all of the big indices, the S&P 500 down 0.18%, Dow down 0.18%, NASDAQ down a little more, 0.26%. But with interest rates going up, the Fed announcing we're going to drive interest rates up, you would certainly think that the markets would say, OMG, we have got to drive down stock prices and all that kind of stuff. Run away from stocks, move toward bonds, and yet that did not happen today. And now, so the question is, why didn't that happen, sir? I know. I saw that. That's why I tried to bring you back there. You need to take that hat off. It's blocking your brain cells from getting oxygen. Madam, why didn't the market have a cow? I mean, interest rates go up. The market should have said, why didn't they do that? And this is actually, you shouldn't know the, well, you kind of might, but I'd be really impressed if you did.
I have no idea.
Okay, here's it. They already knew it was going to happen. So that, so in other words, that information was already in the stock price reactions in days prior to this. What the expectation is going to drive the market. So since this was already expected, that reaction to those interest rate increases had already shown up in the market days, weeks before this. You see, by the time you get information in your position, or even in my position to a certain extent, it's too late to act on it because the market's already, what we say, impounded that information in the stock prices. You'd have to know something that no one else knew was going to happen to be able to profit from what was the reaction of a market. In this case, today had nothing to do with the interest rate increases by the Fed, because that had been impounded in those prices days, weeks ago, you see. So that's why the market didn't have any particular excitement about this. And this is true of a lot of things. We can't say that the markets are efficient. There are different forms of efficiency. Now, I'll go back through this in a subsequent lecture. But the weak, W-E-A-K, form of the efficient market is, we would say, all public information is immediately reflected in stock prices. You can't get in front of it, because if it's public information, the market's going to just jump on it within split seconds. Now, there's two other forms. There's a semi-strong form, which said that those stock prices also contain some, all public information, but also some private information. In other words, there's some leakage from insiders that also is in those stock prices. There is the semi-strong form says that there is some private information, some, that's already in those stock prices, which, of course, that shouldn't happen, but it does. And then there's a final form called the strong form, that those stock prices have all public information and they have all private information already in there. So, I mean, even in the weak form, you're not going to beat the market. You just won't. But in the other forms, and the evidence points to the second, the semi-strong form, that there is all the public information gets into those stock prices just instantly. But it also, there's evidence that some private information is hiding in there too, has gotten in there. It was sort of like there was an announcement 2 weeks ago that the current administration, the current president, was going to slap major tariffs on certain products imported. And of course, that's a bad idea all over the place. We've done that before. The worst scenario was when we did it in the late 1920s to try to get everyone rallied around the country and stop all imports. It was called the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, and that was one of the driving forces that made the Great Depression as bad as it was. When countries start trade retaliation, everyone loses. But anyway, what happened was that this announcement that we were going to slap import tariffs on steel, aluminum, and other products from China, from Canada, from Europe, from Japan, and all that. Well, interestingly enough, what we found out later was that an advisor to the president had a major stake in stock in aluminum manufacturing companies in Canada. And before the announcement was made, well, lo and behold, he'd sold a huge amount of his stock in those companies. That would indicate semi-strong, because some private information had leaked into the prices of Canadian stocks that were related to the, that were going to be adversely affected by the tariffs. So yeah, it gets in there. Can we stop it from getting in there? Well, sometimes we can if we can bust the guys who are using private inside information, but most of the time, we don't even know what's happening. Okay, all that being said, as you can see, the markets right now are actually fairly quiet. It's almost like right now, we're in this mode where it's too quiet. We're waiting, as they used to say, we're waiting for the other shoe to drop. What is going to happen next? And so the markets are going to stay fairly calm until we get some more information. Then as soon as the expectation is formed, before the actual events happen, once solid expectations are formed, then you'll see stock prices react. But right now, it's just wait and see. Not much really exciting new information came in today, so the stock market just kind of drifted aimlessly throughout the day. Now, let me take you to a scenario here. I'm going to leave the lights down because I'm going to show you how to use your calculators to do this. If you want to use formulas to do it, well, by all means, go for it. If you want to use pencil and paper and do adding and subtracting, taking exponents and all that, more power to you. I'm going to show you how to do it on the calculator. It's the title of this lecture, Net Present Value and Internal Rate of Return. Now, before I do this, though, a brief story from my years as a consultant. Now, we know the best practices, and we teach them in our undergraduate programs to you folks, in our MBA programs, and in our PhD programs. Here are the best practices. Here's what we now understand as how to do it. However, we also know, as with many, many other things in life, that there are older methods that are still used in a modern world. Even though we know that they are not the best methods, we know that they're obsolete, antiquated, old-fashioned, and probably downright wrong, we still see these things being used in our lives. When I used to teach English, I would start by teaching Old English, Middle English, and then Early Modern and Modern English. And I would point out that there were these things, even in our own language, that are still fossils that we shouldn't do, but we hold on to them because that's the way it was done long ago, and there are many people who still use that. For example, have you ever noticed that I look, he looks, she looks, they look? We look, there's that one that has that S on the end. It's called an inflection. It's from Old English. We just never got rid of it. And we see this in business, too. There are businesses that still use old methods for project evaluation. In other words, whether we go with a project or not. I didn't really understand that I had classical teaching. Well, everyone's using this method now and this method and all that. And then I got out there in the real world, and I found out there were more than a few businesses that were using methods that are not supposed to be used, long ago repudiated, and yet there they are. Suppose that you have a project. Now, the cost of the project is, let's say, $5,000. Now, you have projected the cash, future expected cash flows from this project. Year, cash flow. Now, year zero is the negative 5,000, okay? Now, year one, two, three, four, 5 and 6. In year one, you're not going to get much. It's not going to be impressive. Maybe $800. Then the product picks up some popularity. In the second year, you're up to $1,200. Third year, $1,500. Fourth year, $1,500. Fifth year, it's beginning to die out with competition and better products. So it's back down to, let's say, $1,000. And then it kind of dies in the fifth year with $500. And there's a salvage value of, let's say, let's give it $200. Now, I'm going to talk about the salvage value a lot more. But suffice it to say that at the end of a life of a project, there's almost always some value remaining that you could cash in, that you could liquidate. Whether or not you do is irrelevant to the analysis. I'm going to tell you a secret, okay? Madam, there is a very large room in the basement of this building. There really is. They're talking about converting it into student study space or something like that, but right now it's closed and it's locked. Now, never mind the fact that we keep old, dead students in there. They're not really dead. They're like zombies. They took accounting and it got to them the wrong way. I shouldn't have said that. Yes, I should have. It's true. But also down there, in that room, when I went down there a few years back, I was on a ghost hunt, okay, and I found a way in there. Yeah, that's how I know about those kids. Anyway, you'll see there are these rows of these ancient computers. I mean, by your standards, for me, I'd say, ooh, a classic. But, I mean, they're just old computers. I don't know if you remember the time when these computers were these big blocks. You know, they had a little monitor. I've got a 34-inch monitor. They had some down there that had these like 12-inch screens, and they were all green when you turned them on. They had all of these drives that back in the day, hard drives were insanely expensive. So we used these floppy disks, but they weren't the hard kind. They were these big things that you, and they had modems down there. Now, you're used to a modem that, you know, you're used to cable and things like that that run at like, oh, mine runs at 150 megabits per second. Well, these were 12,000, 12K modems. I mean, ultra fast for their time, but now it'd just be, okay, they're all over down there, okay, lining the walls. You see, that was salvage value that was never realized. But when we made the decisions to upgrade computers, those salvage values should have been put in at the time we made the decisions to change over. Whether they were or not, I don't know. But many companies, they just leave equipment in a big warehouse, or they just send it to a scrapyard. They don't actually realize the salvage value. That does not mean it's not there. It's just that they did not realize it. And so when you see me write a salvage value, you put that on the last year's cash flow. So in other words, year six is not 500. Year six is 200 plus 500. Make sure you always do that. Now, in the problems in the book, sometimes they'll say the salvage value is zero. Sometimes they'll give you a positive salvage value. Put it in the last years. So immediately your reaction should be, okay, cross out that 500, put 700 there. Okay? Just do that. Yeah. Did you have a question?
What would you want us to just say, like, in basic terms, the definition of salvage?
Salvage value is the recoverable asset value liquidated at the end of the project. Salvage value, well, you can say a little more. Salvage value is the liquidatable value of the project at its end. Just say value of the project at its end. Yeah, is the liquidatable value of the project at the end. almost everything has some value at the end. Look, when your company decides to go with new computers, at worst, you could donate those to a school. In this country or in some second or third world country, and realize a tax break from the donations. So even if they're out of date, they're obsolete, almost nothing has no value unless you've really worn it completely into the ground. So just keep that in mind. Okay, now, and this is the method that you shouldn't use, but it's still there. To find out whether a project is a go or a no-go. It's called the payback method. The payback method merely sets a policy for a number of years and says any project we are considering must pay back the initial cost within this number of years. When I was a consultant, the first two gigs, they were using payback method, even though I know they had been taught a better method, the one I'm going to teach you after this. But I have to show it to you because you might run into it. Okay, madam, pick a number of years. Nothing ridiculous, just a few years.
Six.
Try a little lower number.
Five.
Say four. You don't know what I'm looking for there, so that's okay. But here's the deal. Let's say that their policy in the company is a four-year payback. So in other words, what I would do is I would say, all right, this costs $5,000. Well, after 1 year, it's got $800. After 2 years, it's got $2,000. After 3 years, it's got $3,500. After 4 years, it has $5,000. So this barely makes it into the payback period. So they'd say yes. This one just barely pays for itself in terms of the cost at the marker, at the hurdle. Now, if that had been $1,400 in year four, well, then they'd say no, because it didn't meet the payback hurdle. This method, again, I think I saw a study that was done last year or the year before that. They were finding out what method for project acceptance was being used in large and medium-sized companies. They had a lot of companies, thousands. And they found out that it was something like 25% of companies are still using this payback method, which is a staggering because it's wrong. And here's the easiest way to explain it. They're not taking the time value of money into account. You're spending $5,000 right now. But those cash flows positive are out there in the future. So their now value, so you could really compare them to the $5,000, is less than what you're seeing there. In other words, $800 in 1 year is not $800. It's a little less. It's $800 divided by 1 plus your discount rate. $1,200 in 2 years is less. It's actually right now, to compare it to that negative $5,000, you'd have to take $1,200 divided by 1 plus your discount rate to the second power. So in other words, they're treating those cash flows in the future as if they are the same as money now, which they're not. Money in the future is worth less now. And the higher the discount rate you use, the less it is worth now. So the payback method is giving too much weight to future values, which it should not. And there's another one here too, which you'll see in actually even the good methods comes out. The 4 years that I picked, that you just pull it out of your hat. It has no mathematical legitimacy like a discount rate does. It's just a number that is comes out of nowhere. As a matter of fact, the company I was telling you about, one of the two companies I first consulted for, they had a payback period of 5 years for all projects. I said, well, where's 5 years come from? Just kind of probing to see what if they understood that they were doing something wrong. Oh, we just always have. That's the way we've always done it. My father, when he started the business, he had 5 years. We've always had 5 years. No other reason for picking 5 years. Just that was what you did. And so it's essentially, it is one of the things where there's no way to legitimize a choice of the number of years. You just have it. And like I said, one of the methods you're going to see here in a little bit has that same once in a while someone does it wrong. Well, not once in a while, quite often does it wrong by just pulling a number out of thin air. Well, we've always used this number, so we're going to just keep using it, despite the fact that there's no justification other than that's just what they do. Anyway, that's the payback method. And it's easy. Don't get me wrong. This is easy to use. And apparently, according to that study, it's being done by like a fourth of the companies that were surveyed. To this day, they're still using this flawed method. So why don't all these companies go out of business? It's generally because if they did it right, they'd come to about the same conclusion sometimes. Have you taken advanced courses in physics? No, you have not. Are you in your undergraduate career planning on taking courses in differential equations? It's an advanced part of mathematics. No? No vector calculus? No abstract algebra? No topology? No. But you can still drive a car. We write these equations that can describe it in incredibly accurate detail. But you don't need that to drive a car, you see. Now, see, so even when businesses use methods that are dodgy, questionable, we know that there's an internal sense of what they should be looking at that kind of transcends their analysis. So the analysis can be flawed, but they can still come to the right decisions in a lot of different situations. So it's not a tragedy the companies are doing this, but it's better in the modern world when you're competing with companies that are more accurate, that use best methods, if you are with them on the same page using the same methods. The same methods that would have built a good airplane in 1935. Would not build a competitive airplane, even though it would fly, it would not build an airplane that was competitive with other airplanes in 2018. So anyway, enough of that. Now, let's go on to the real method. And I'm, as you've seen, I've done this before on a number of occasions. I just show you, here's how we do it. And then I go back and I explain how we did it. Now, on this one, I'm going to pull a number out of my hat. And later, you'll see how we get the discount rate we use. But we're going to actually take the present value of each of these pieces and bring it back to the present and then compare it to what it cost. This is called net present value, NPV. Net present value. And though it's not capitalized when you write it out, just but when you do this NPV. Okay, net present value works like this. Now, the method, again, to get the discount rate, I'll show you in 2 weeks. But for now, let's say we discount future expected cash flows at 8% on this project. Now, remember that that discount rate is actually going to reflect the risk of the project. So a highly risky project would come out with a higher discount rate. A safer project would come out with a lower discount rate. But for this one, I'm pulling 8%. And so, first of all, remember, you take that 200 and you put it on last year's cash flow, 700. Now, I'm going to do this in the abstract. Okay? As a matter of fact, let me turn on the light so you can see a little better here. I'll turn it back down when I use the calculator. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I am going to bring all of these back, 800. So that one would be 800 divided by 1 plus 0.10 to the first power. Bring back the two-year. That would be 1,200 divided by the 1 plus 0.10 to the second power. Bring back the third one. Oh, I'm just testing you to see if you're watching me. It is 0.08. That was good. I was worried that no one would see that I was doing that with the wrong... Okay. Okay. $1,500 took the wind out of my sails there real fast. 0.08. No wonder I've screwed up so many companies in my life. No, seriously, noobs. I keep saying, well, I've done this many companies, that many companies. I've actually done 18 companies. I counted them. And of those, all but two crashed and burned. I mean, I looked up to see if that was a record, and it wasn't, so I couldn't, you know, high-five myself or anything. But... to the fourth power, bring back the 1,000, you discount it back 5 years, 1,000 divided by 1 plus 0.08 to the fifth, and then you bring back the last one, the 700, divided by 1 plus 0.08 to the sixth power. You add those numbers up, and if they are bigger than $5,000, you say yes. If the sum of them is less than $5,000, you say no. That's the net present value method. Now, as you can see, if you've got a multi-year project, that can get to be a lot like work, adding those numbers up and summing them and all that. Fortunately, we don't have to do that. We can use the calculator to do exactly what I just did there without the suffering and the pain and all of that. Here's how you do it. Okay, now, turn on the calculator. You just hit Apps, Finance. Now, you go down to number 7. You can even key in just the number 7 or toggle down to 7, NPV. And it returns you to the front screen, NPV, open parenthesis. Now, the first thing you're going to do is put in the interest rate, 8%. Then you're going to put in a comma. And you're going to put in the initial negative cash outflow. Negative $5,000. Now, here's where you have to watch yourself. You put in a comma, and then you open up braces. That's second on the parenthesis. And then you just, one after the other, you put in the positive cash flows. 800, comma, 1,200, comma, 1,500, comma, 1,500, comma, 1,000, comma, 700. Now, then you close the braces, second close parenthesis, and then you close the original open parenthesis, and you say, enter. Well, butter my biscuits and call me delicious. That is a positive number. The country style biscuits, they have kind of a slight shell crispy, and then on the inside they're really, anyway. It's a positive number. All it has to be is positive by a dollar. It really doesn't matter that this one's positive $184. It's positive. So you say, yes, the project is a go. If that had been negative, even a little negative, you would say no. That project is a no-go. But in this case, the project was positive, so we say, absolutely, this is a go. Let's get it done. And that, yeah.
So, okay, this method, if we add them all together, they would have to be over $5,000 for it to be something we should do.
Well, you add those present values together. Yes. You see, when I put those numbers in there in those braces, what I was telling is take 800 divided by 1.08 to the first, plus 1,200 divided by 1.08 to the second, etc. So this is doing that heavy lifting, that thing that I wrote there on the board. See, this is doing that right there. And it's doing it at a discount rate of 8%, which I was doing there. And it is also finishing up by subtracting the $5,000 initial cost, all without you doing anything but keying in the numbers. Now, you can do it this way if you choose to, or you can do it the accounting way where you go into those tables in the back of the book and look up each of those values, or, you know, you can use the payback method. Yeah.
So it's not that if you add them all up.
No, you're not adding them up. That's payback. Yeah, putting this together. And all you want to know is this plus this plus this plus this plus this plus this, is it more than that initial amount? So in other words, negative 5,000 plus this formula plus this one plus this one plus this one plus this one plus this one, is that a positive or a negative number? In this case, it's positive, $184. All you have to do is run the calculator this way. Now, I'm going to draw a graph, and then I'll just sort of... Okay, on the horizontal axis, I'm writing discount rate from 1%, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10%. Okay, so now on the horizontal axis, I'm going to be writing the NPV. Do $100, $200, $300, $400, $500, $600, $700, and then down on the other side, -$100, $200, $300, $400, -$500. Okay. Now, what I did here was I actually calculated a single point on the net present value function. I found that at an 8% discount rate, the net present value was $184, a point right about there. The next thing I'm going to do is find out, well, what would have happened? What would have happened? This calculator turned off. Did you see that? It turned off again. That just Anyway, okay. Now, suppose we had done this calculation with, let's say, 9% instead of 8%. Now, you don't have to go back through it again. Just hit second, enter, and it allows you to open the formula again and go back in and change whatever you need to. So I just hit second enter. What I just did pops back up, and now I'll just key in a 9 where I had an 8. You do know that you can do that, right? You don't have to re-key in formulas. Okay, yeah. Because that's just the way the formula works. Remember I told you financial calculators, they think that you should put in percentages when mathematically that really is 0.08. But with these financial calculators, they, in financial mode, see, this is actually a scientific calculator. But as soon as you put it into any kind of a financial calculator, they think finance people are too stupid to know that a percent is actually a decimal. I guess that's the only thing. I said second enter. And it will open the formula again. And I just push the cursor back up to where I needed it. Now let me do this again. Enter. Oh, it's still positive, even at 9%. $32. So at 9%, I can put another point. 9%, about $32. Well, this is interesting. Let me try 10%. See what happens if I had decided, oh, 9% wasn't right. It should be 10%. I'll go second, enter, and then I'll go back up, and this time I'm going to have to do 1 and then put in insert, second insert, to get another number. It slid in there. Okay. Yeah, it will overwrite 1. But the next, if you have to put in more than 1, then you have to put in insert, so it moves everything over. Okay, now let's hit enter. Oh, negative $113. Down there. So in other words, really right about there. I got, this is a net present value function. As noticed that net present value functions are downward sloping. In calculus, you would say the first derivative is negative. You remember that from calculus, the derivative of a line? If it's an upward sloping line, the derivative is positive. First derivative is positive, second derivative, anyway, is zero. Anyway, there you go. So now, there's something very special that has happened here. But first of all, this is the best practices method, the net present value method, is the best practices method currently in effect. Now, I've mentioned a while back that these very high technology giant industrial companies are now using something that is on the other side of crazy to do their decision making. It comes from something called the options pricing model. It's used only by the very largest companies and used by the guru priests at the top of the tower and all that. For the most part, almost any company that is with best practices methods is going to use the net present value method. Now, the other method comes from the net present value method, but it is risky to use. because it can give you flawed answers. However, look here. Do you see where that net present value function crosses from a positive NPV to a negative NPV? If you remember from your algebra days, we call the crossing point or points the roots of a function. You remember parabolas, find the roots where it's zeros and zeros. That's what you're finding. That thing right there is called the root. But in finance, we call it the internal rate of return. It is, you write this down, the discount rate that makes the net present value equal zero. It is the discount rate that makes the net present value zero. It's special because, in other words, any discount rate below that that you would use, you'd say it's a go. Any discount rate that you would use above that, you would say the project is a no-go. Okay? Again, any discount rate that you would actually use for the NPV that was below the internal rate of return, the project would be a go. See, because if I use 5%, 6%, 7%, 8%, 9%, in all those cases, the NPV would come out to be positive. But if I were to use a discount rate of 10%, 11%, or anything above those, the NPV would be negative, and I'd say it's a no-go. So if I know the internal rate of return, then you can give me a discount rate, and I'll immediately be able to tell you whether it's a go or no-go. Suppose that I did this, found this internal rate of return. Okay? Well, once I know the internal rate of return, you just tell me what the discount rate is, and I'll say yes or no. Now, how do we find this? Here's how we did it in the old days. We would actually start finding the NPV of projects using higher and higher discount rates until we hit one where the NPV was negative. And then we would back down and work our way recalculating NPV using tighter and tighter band on the discount rates. That was way too much like work. However, actually, the way we cheated, by the time I got to the higher level courses, what we would do is we would just calculate the NPV on one side, and then when we calculate a ridiculously high, using a real high discount rate on the other side, then we would draw the graph, and we'd say, ah, right there. So if I'm looking at this, I would say that internal rate of return is probably what? About 9.2%, something like that. Do you see that? Okay, now watch. I don't have to. It turned off again. Okay, now watch this. Now I'm not even going to enter. First of all, watch this. Second, I shouldn't do that because that's just going to make you really sloppy like I am. Apps, finance. Now go down to number 8. You see it there, number 8, IRR. Hit enter, and you come back to the main screen. Now in this case, it's entered just like NPV, except you don't put in a discount rate because it's going to find the discount rate. So in this case, I start with just the negative $5,000, comma, open braces, and then you just honk in those cash flows. They were 800, comma, 1200, comma, 1500, comma, 1500, comma, 1,000, comma, 700. Close the braces, second close parenthesis, and then close the opening parenthesis that was way up above, and now hit enter. You notice it'll take a little bit. Oh, I'm good. Uh-huh. Do you see that? The internal rate of return is 9.21%. So that, right? Yeah, go ahead.
Why does
it keep getting
errors or something I'm doing wrong?
Yes. If you're getting, did you use braces to open the cash flows? Where is, let me see your calculator. What was it? What did he do? Go on. Ah, yeah. Those aren't brackets. Those are braces. The brackets are the square ones, the braces. The brackets are important in other places. Oh, don't be imprecise with me, woman. Anyway. No, but yeah, there you go. That's the internal rate of return. So what that means is that once I know an internal rate of return, so think about it this way. You get the cost and the future expected cash flows for a project. You just run the internal rate of return, and then whenever they decide to get back to you and tell you the discount rate, you can tell them instantly whether it's a yes or a no. So suppose that you were given the cost of the project and the cash flows, and you just run that as the internal rate of return, and you find out that the internal rate of return is 7.8%. So then, a week later, they say, oh, I want you to use a discount rate of 10%. You don't even have to do anything. You just say, no. That's above the internal rate of return, so the project is a no, right there. The internal rate of return is actually, from my experience, somewhat more popular than the net present value. But it has two problems with it. One is a theoretical problem that'll bite you in the butt in practice. And the other is how the internal rate of return is used. The first problem, it starts as a theoretical problem. Back from your days in high school algebra, you see that cash flow pattern right there? It switches signs once from negative to positive. Practically speaking, projects don't always do that. Sometimes you pour money in, you start generating net cash flow, and then a few years later, you have to pour money in again to get more net cash flow. Okay, no big thing there, except that if the cash flow switches signs more than once, the net present value function is no longer linear. If it switches signs twice, it's a second degree, a parabola. If it switches signs three times, it's a third degree. In other words, sign switch on cash flow. Yeah. One switch, the NPV function will be downward sloping a line. One IRR. Two, it will do that. It'll be a parabola. Three, it'll be a cubic function. In other words, the internal rate of return has no meaning. It actually has no meaning. The problem, though, is there. I watched. Did you see it? I watched it turn off on me. Anyway, in this problem, well, what was it? Oh. If I key in, if the thing, let's say, has three sign switches or two sign switches, I can still run the internal rate of return calculation and it will give me an answer. And that's the problem, is that there really isn't an answer. So in other words, let me erase some stuff here real quick. Suppose I was looking at a project that had negative cash flow, then a few years of positive, then a negative for a year, and then more years of positive. Its NPV function would look like that. The calculator, I can't even tell you which one it would choose, but it would start looking somewhere. The way calculators work, just at extremely high speed, they do what's called an iterative search. It's a, go this way, go that way, go this way, that way, that way. And then it finds the zero to a certain number of decimals of accuracy. Depending upon where it started its search, it could have given you this answer or this answer, but it'll tell you an answer. But neither of those answers is correct because there isn't an internal rate of return in the financial sense. It's what we call a spurious result. A spurious result. That's the problem, is that these answers that it does in that are not correct. Okay? So that's the theoretical flaw that can come back to get you in real life. Go.
Could you just find both of the bottom lines and take the range from which is positive for both?
Nope, because that actually doesn't mean anything in this case. I'm glad you asked that. That's an interesting question. You see, the NPV function itself is anomalous, as we say. And we have to... We reach for a deeper method, for our discount rate. This is where you have to step up to the plate and say, give me a discount rate. That will tell me the NPV, okay? In other words, let's not play around trying to find an internal rate of return. Let's find the discount rate and just use that and find NPV positive or negative and push aside the internal rate of return. Now, there's another, there are three problems. Now there's another problem. Here's a practical use. Here's how a lot of companies use internal rate of return. They create what is called a hurdle rate. It's sort of like that old payback method where they just pick a number of years. I ran into quite a few companies I have recently, just in the last month, companies that say our company policy is to have a hurdle rate on projects. And they give a number, a hurdle rate. So here's how it works. Suppose that a company had a hurdle rate. It said, no project can have a hurdle. Let's start. Let's say the hurdle rate is 10%. In other words, they will accept no project with an internal rate of return below 10%. Again, the hurdle rate is, and I'll say this in technical, the hurdle rate is the minimum internal rate of return a project must attain to be accepted. The hurdle rate is the minimum internal rate of return that any project must attain to be accepted. Let me explain in practice. We find project and IRR. We run the cash flows for a bunch of projects, let's say. We've got run four projects. Project A, Project B, Project C, and Project D. internal rate of return for project A is 8%. Project 8.0%. We run it through the TI-83 or through Excel. By the way, you can also do this in Excel. It's the equals NPV function and it equal or the equals IRR function. So you can do this, lay out the cash flows in a column and then reference that column for this. Okay, A was 8%, B was 13.6%, C was 10.9%, and D was 9.1%. With a hurdle rate of 10%, we would accept project B and project C. Here's why. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. Okay. Okay, now let's look at these internal rates of return. For project A, it crossed the horizontal axis at 8%. So that's the project A net present value function. Now look at the 10% hurdle rate. Do you see that at 10% this project is negative NPV? The hurdle rate's right here, 10%. Do you see that this project A, it crossed into negative territory at 8%, so it's a no-go at 10%. Look at project B. It crossed at 13.6% up here, so its NPV profile had to look like this. Do you see that at 10%, it's still wildly positive? That's project B. Project C crossed at 10.9%. So its NPV function looked like that. So at 10%, it's still a positive project. And project D crossed at 9.1%. So it has gone into negative territory by the time it gets to the hurdle rate. That's the hurdle rate method. It doesn't use the NPV. It uses the internal rate of return of project to say yes or no. You see the problem with this method? Yeah?
What if the rate for like project A is at like 5%?
Well, there's an interesting thing. They've got a problem with your discount. Are these all the same risk projects? That's definitely an issue. There's one that's a little easier. It is, where did they get the 10%? The hurdle rate is just pulled out of thin air. Some companies use their cost of capital for it, which is a stupid idea, their weighted average cost of capital. The incident I told you about that just happened very recently, I was at a nice dinner with some finance people at a company here in town, and I was mentioning something about, I get them to the NPV and the internal rate of return. It's pretty easy because of the calculator. And he asked, well, what about hurdle rate? And I said, well, you guys use hurdle rate? Oh, yeah, always have. What's your hurdle rate? 13.5%. I said, well, where did you get that? Well, that's our policy. Well, how long have you been using that hurdle rate? Well, I don't know, since I've been there. He'd been there 12 years. The other guy had been there 8 years. They had not changed that rate in all those years. Despite the ups and downs of interest rates in the economy, they'd been holding to this. It's, again, one of those kinds of numbers. Someone somewhere in the past pulled it up and said, here is the Holy Grail. It's written in stone, use this forever, and they're still using it. I said, well, interest rate fell through the floor for the last, like, 3, 4, 5 years.
Why didn't you bring the hurdle rate down? Well, we just didn't. So in other words, they were rejecting projects that would have been perfectly good for them to do. If they'd had a hurdle rate down, see, if I put the hurdle rate at 3%, all of those projects would have been go. But with the hurdle rate static, I mean, you're going to reject projects even when the interest rate environment is very low. Okay, that's all I have for you today. I thank you.